morning, everyone. I'd like to know what's going on outside. I just spent the last 5 or 6 days in Boston where they really know how to have storms. Believe me, yesterday morning I got up and they had a wind chill factor -2 degrees Fahrenheit going on outside, which was fine. I only had to go out in it, no big deal. But then I come home, I think, I'm going to come home, it's going to be nice and warm and everything. It's like, what's going on? Don't blame me, I did not bring it with me, because this is nothing compared to what they get. But so anyway, I'm glad to be back. I haven't had a chance really to talk with Erica very much, but from what little I know, it sounds like she did a very good job. We will be figuring out today, you're going to help me to know exactly what she covered. She's given me an indication, and I tried to put together some review sheets that reflect what my understanding is, and so we'll work on that a little bit together, and then we'll know. It's especially important because what's happening day after tomorrow? Midterm exam. The midterm exam, I've decided, is going to just go through last Thursday's lecture. So even though I have some more to talk with you about on the immune system today, that is not going to be on the midterm exam. So whatever happened through last Thursday is what that exam is going to be on. And I put this list together based on what I think I got covered on Thursday, based on the notes that she left me. So if I'm off on this a little bit, we'll figure that out today. Anyway, there will be question and answer sessions tomorrow. Again, at 1:30 and, no, at 12:30 and again at 3:30, right, in Science 165, the other lab room in the other corner. So I'd welcome you all to come and join me in that and bring your questions, and let's see what kind of answers we can come up with for that and so forth. So it'll be a similar exam to the first exam. Different questions, of course, but it's a similar kind of an exam. So that's what we're looking for there. Let's talk about lab for a minute. So we've got, you know, we spent the last couple of weeks working on the fetal pigs, and I assume that you've all been reminded that this week we're doing the kind of the culminating quiz on the fetal pig called the practical exam, because we're actually going to use the pigs as our material for the exams. And so I know some of you may be wondering what in the world's going to be on this and so forth. You just go back and review those last couple of labs that we did. Pretty much asking questions about naming structures, what the functions of the structures, what's connected to what, maybe the anatomical directions a little bit and so forth, but those are the kinds of things that are going to be on this quiz. It's not designed, I hope it's not designed to be a killer quiz, it's just designed to kind of see how awake you've been the last couple of weeks as you've been working on the pigs and so forth. So keep that in mind. Our plan is, when you come into lab, to give you probably a half hour or so to get your pig out and to review things and so forth, and then shoo everybody out of the lab and set up the quiz real quickly. So, but once you get to lab, that'll get explained to you more completely. Yeah. So how it might be formatted. We'll be using your pigs, okay? And what we'll do is probably have maybe a dozen pigs. It kind of depends on how many pigs there are in the lab, but I'd be shooting for maybe a dozen pigs. And so those will become what we call stations, okay? So you've got a dozen stations around the room that you're going to have to visit. And each station will have one or two pins with identification letters or something stuck into something in the pig or whatever. And then there will be questions about that. Like, the simplest possible question pair might be, what is the name of that structure and what is its function? Or other kinds of questions that might be related to that sort of thing. That's what that's going to look like. And you're going to have to go around and look at all 12 stations and answer the questions. So it will be a kind of a fill-in-the-blank sort of quiz. There's nothing. We will provide you with no answers. Okay, you'll provide us with all the answers. Hopefully, they'll all be the good answers. Review your lecture, your lab books, and the drawings, and all that kind of stuff, and you'll have another
one last chance to look at those guys before we go to it.
Make sure that you look at both sexes of pigs so that you're familiar with the sex organs in both sexes of pigs and you understand those systems. Okay, any other questions about that? Okay. Every quiz will be different because we'll be kind of setting them up on the fly. Nothing has been predetermined in this quiz other than kind of a large common set of questions that we might be using. Okay. Okay, so last time Eric talked to you about the immune system, right? And it sounds like she really either she can talk really, really fast or she really got plowed through a lot of material. So this is what my understanding. So you talked about kind of the basics, you know, what's the immune system about? You know, recognizing foreign substances, and of course there are lots of different categories of foreign substances. It might be organisms themselves. It might be cells of your own that have been infected, say with viruses, and all of a sudden they look different to your body. So we call those altered self cells, where they start to look different from your own body cells. Might be cells that have been put in there by a doctor in a transplant operation. You know, and your immune system sees this strange heart there, and it knows its job is to get rid of that foreign invader. So people that have transplants are always on immunosuppressant drugs to kind of keep the immune system from getting rid of the transplant. So lots of things. So self, altered self, non-self. Those were the categories of things. Of course, we don't want the immune system to be reacting to self. Right, and that's where autoimmune diseases come from, when the immune system kind of, for one reason or another, goes a little bit crazy and begins to react to your own cells and eliminate them, and that's never got a good outcome. So those are the things. So recognizing things, communicating, eliminating, and so forth. So you heard about kind of non-specific body defenses, the skin being our first defense against illness, right? It's or the skin and other surfaces that are contiguous with the outside. So it's not just the skin on the outside, but it's the whole lining of your digestive tract, right? It's your lungs, your nasal cavities, and so forth. Anything that has a connection with the outside world is a potential route in for invaders to get in and infect you. So that's kind of our first response, and you heard about the inflammatory response and what goes on, at least an example of what goes on in the case of, say, a wound, a cut or something like that, where bacteria get in and your body mounts a defense against that. But call that nonspecific because it'll mount that kind of a defense for whatever, right? We're not reacting to specific things that come in with the inflammatory response. We're just reacting to the fact that there's been an injury, and we need to make sure that any invaders that got in are well taken care of, and so forth. So the non-specific response. And then you heard about specific responses. Okay, so our bodies react in very specific ways to certain invaders that get in. And there were two kinds that Erica talked about last time, right? There was the humoral response, which is fluid-based. And we generally think of that as blood-based, but it doesn't have to be blood-based. Any kind of secretion, saliva, tears, and so forth can have antibodies in them that are helping us to kill bacteria and other invaders that may be trying to get in. So that's the humoral fluid-based, and then there was the cell-mediated that came up later on, where we actually have cells in the immune system that are attacking things. So a couple of different ways. Now, you heard about antibodies, right? Antibodies are really interesting proteins that we find in the body. So that's kind of an artist's rendition of what an antibody might look like. It's our understanding that all antibodies look like this. They've got kind of this Y-shaped structure, right? And they're composed of several proteins, a couple of long proteins, a couple of short proteins that come together. But the big point about the antibodies was that they will bind to these things that we call antigens. Remember, an antigen is something that will elicit an immune response. Generally, it's a protein. Some sort of a foreign protein that's gotten into you, either maybe it's a toxin, you got a rattlesnake bite, it's a toxin, or it's a protein on the outside of a bacterial cell, or a protein on the outside of a virus, or it's a protein that a virus is causing to be made in one of your cells once it infects and starts putting those into your cell membrane. That's where we get the altered self kinds of cells. So generally it's a protein, but it could be a carbohydrate, it could be other things also. These antigens that will elicit this response, right? And there were two antigen binding sites on every antibody. And that's an important point for part of the way the response occurs. They're identical, right? Both of these binding sites are going to bind to the same antigen. She talked about how before you've been confronted with a particular antigen, you've got these what we call B cells, right? The B cells. What, do you remember why is a B cell called a B cell? Where do they form? Bone marrow, right? So B cells, bone marrow. B cells circulating that have all these different potential, all these different antibodies presenting on the outside, right? And then if an antigen comes along that binds tightly to one of those, then there's a whole process that's initiated where that B cell will start to divide and divide and divide and divide and divide, and eventually form a bunch of specialized B cells that were called plasma cells, whose sole function is to produce gobs of that antibody. Pour that antibody out into the blood, let that antibody go out in search of those antigens, those hopefully foreign antigens. All right, so there was that. And then, remember, the way that we retain a memory of this having been confronted with this antigen was because some of those B cells will form memory cells. All right, so we're going to always have, always may be too big a word, but for at least for a long, long period of time, after you've been confronted with a particular antigen, you're going to have a memory of that in your immune system. So that the next time you're confronted with that antigen, you're going to get a much faster reaction. It takes like, 10 days to get your initial reaction. So if you get a particularly nasty bacteria, say, into your system, that can kill you before 10 days, then you might just die before your immune system can even begin to mount a response to it. But if you've been immunized, and that's the whole idea behind immunization, is to get us past that primary response, build up those memory cells. If you've been immunized, and then you come in contact with that nasty bacteria or whatever it was, you'll get a much, much more rapid response, and you may get sick, but you're probably not going to die. You may not even get sick, depending on how fast the response is. So those memory cells are really important to have circulating in the body. Every so often you hear, well, you've got to get a booster shot, right? You've been immunized for various things, you've got to go in and get a booster shot. And that's to bring the memory cell population back up again. And I think a lot of that probably is because a lot of the things we get immunized against are pretty rare. And so every so often, the memory cells will last for periods of years, but as time goes on, the quantity is going to go down, down, down. So every so often you get that booster shot to bring them back up. If it's something that you come into contact with more regularly, though, you're probably not going to need a booster shot because you're constantly coming into contact with it. You're constantly reestablishing that memory line for those things. So that was the humoral response utilizing the antibodies. Remember the antibodies? I think she talked about how they'll do a couple of different things. One thing that they'll do is to bind to that antigen, and that might involve coating a bacterial cell. If it's got that antigen on the outside, coating that cell, and that marks that cell for destruction. And then macrophages, big amoeboid-type white blood cells, will come along, respond to that, and gobble up those cells so they're tagged. Remember, it's this stem region down here that's actually going to mark that, because as the antibodies bind to the antigen that's on the surface of the cell, those are pointing down now towards the surface of the cell. This is what's pointing out. So the stem region is really important for labeling things for destruction. So that was one way that antibodies might work. Another way antibodies might work, remember, was by causing what we called agglutination. That's, I'm sure she used that term, didn't she? Agglutination. Say yes, please. Agglutination, where you want, because you've got two binding sites, you can actually have one bind to each of two different organisms. Right? So again, if you're looking at, say, bacteria, you can actually bind two bacteria together. And then if you multiply that by a whole bunch of antibodies that are binding, you get this agglutination where the cells all stick together. And they'll be marked for getting rid of too. By the way, that's how we do our blood typing. Our ABO blood typing is based on this kind of, based on agglutination that occurs. So if you want to know if you what type of blood you've got, at least with the ABO system and also with the RH system, all it takes is two drops of blood. In one drop, you'll put some anti-A antibody to the A antigen. In the other drop, you'll put some antibody to the B antigen. Stir those up. See if they agglutinate or not. If they agglutinate, that means you're carrying that particular antigen. So, like, if they agglutinate to the B antibody and not the A antibody, then you say, oh, you got type B blood because you're carrying the B antigen. It agglutinated in the B. Or if it agglutinates in the A and not the B, then you got type A blood. If it agglutinates in both of them, you got type AB blood. You're carrying both markers. If it agglutinates in neither of them, you're carrying type O blood. Okay, so that's the basis for that for us. Something I'll talk a little bit more about next term for those of you that are in the class next term. And we'll look at that in a little more detail. So antibodies, really important for helping protect us from various kinds of diseases. I think you probably saw this diagram where it talks about what's going on. So we've got all of these B cells that have all their unique antibodies presented to the outside, just waiting to come across an antigen that's going to bind tightly to it. And again, if it does, it will go into mass production and so forth. And one of the puzzles has always, was anyway, how can it be that we can produce so many thousands of different antibodies? How can it be that we can produce antibodies to things that have never existed in nature? Man-made kinds of things, how can that be? And people were kind of puzzled about that, thinking, wow, you know, we don't have enough genes in the book here to make all of those different antibodies, let alone everything else that we have to make. Because at the time, people were thinking, estimating we had about 100,000 genes in the human genome. Now that we know that the correct number is closer to 20 to 25,000 genes, that would be even more puzzling, except for the fact that these antibodies are made from a complex assortment of genes. There are really only about 700 genes or so, and they keep getting rearranged. Their gene products keep getting rearranged in various ways, and that's how we get all the different thousands and thousands of different antibodies being formed that we might form, and even to novel things that we've never seen before. So people figured that out. That was nice to know that the impossible that we were seeing really wasn't so impossible, that it worked out that way. Okay, so that was the antibodies. Bottom attracts macrophages that engulf and destroy the invaders, or complement proteins that form holes in the invader's cells. The complement proteins are in the blood, right? They're circulating in the blood, and those antibodies may attract those complement proteins. Those are really interesting proteins because they literally insert themselves into the cell membrane and create a large hole. Not just a little pore, a large hole, so all the contents leak out and that kills the cell. I don't know if Erica talked much more about the stem. So it's a marker, but it also determines where those antibodies are going to be found. So most antibodies, we generally think of them as being found circulating in the blood or in the saliva or in the mother's milk or whatever. That's why when a baby's born, early on their immune system isn't mature at all. And they get their immunity from their mom's milk, from antibodies that are being secreted into the milk and being transferred through to them. But we also know that antibodies are found in other locations. Like there are some where they're actually embedded into the cell membrane. And we'll talk more about those today because they're involved in the allergic response. When we respond to an allergen that causes us to have untold misery and so forth. It's a different structure to this that causes it. Rather than being in the liquid, it's actually inserted in the membrane with the binding sites pointing out. And of course, that's the same situation here. So we talk about five different kinds of these proteins.
Right, these immunoglobulin proteins, the IG proteins, and there were three in particular that we're interested in this class.
Right, the IgG that's in the blood, that's the one that you normally are thinking of, the IgA that's in the body secretions, and then the IgE, which is the nasty one again that gives you the allergies, that's bound to certain cells in the skin and mucous membranes and blood and so forth. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. Okay, so those are three of the five. Those are the three most important of the antibodies. Let me know if I get to the point here where Erica didn't really talk about this, because as far as I know, everything we're going to talk about for the next few minutes is stuff that you heard. Okay, talk primary response, that first response to a novel antigen takes several days to bring up, and then the secondary response where you get that much, much more rapid response, right? So that was the humoral response, the fluid-based response. And then there was the cell-mediated response. And as you can see here, it's non-self, altered self, cells, parasites, cancer, transplants, viral infected cells, things like that, where there are actually cells of the immune system that will come and attack. These cells are identified as non-self or altered self kinds of cells. And try to get rid of them. So the B cells were involved in the making of the antibodies, right? Bone marrow, that's where they're produced. The T cells are the ones that are involved in this response. Now, it's not that they're not produced in the bone marrow. They are, but they mature in the thymus gland. Okay, and in fact, I think it's thought that some of them may actually be created in the thymus gland too, but they at least mature in the thymus gland, so that's why they're called T cells rather than B cells, right? And the T cells do a lot of things for us. There's a maturation process that goes on with them that's kind of interesting, because certain cells of your immune system are constantly taking in cells or pieces of cells. They're constantly chewing them up. They don't have teeth. They're digesting them and so forth. They're constantly taking proteins that are parts of these cells that they're taking in, and they're moving them to the outside of the cell. And we call that, we say that they're presenting them to the outside of the cell in order to see whether that cell was a self cell or an altered cell or whatever. That's part of the whole response to the immune system, is chewing these things up and moving proteins to the outside of the cell where the immune system can then see them and get access to them. And in the thymus gland, where these particular ones mature, any cells, potential T cells that are presenting your own proteins to the outside, those presumably are weeded out. Those are killed. Those are done away with, because we don't want to get a response to our own cells. We want to respond to other kinds of cells. So that's one of the functions of this maturation of the thymus gland, is weeding out these cells that would cause a reaction to our own cells. But if they're presenting proteins that are not recognized as our own, as part of our own assortment, then those cells go ahead and mature and get released into circulation. So some really important kinds of cells, the helper T cells, critically important for bringing up an immune response. So you're confronted with something new. The first cells really that are going to respond to that likely are helper T cells, which then are going to communicate with other cells that they've been in response, get those B cells going once they've bound the antigen and so forth, and really bring up that immune response, that first immune response. So they're really, really important. If something happens to our helper T cell population, then we lose the ability to respond to various kinds of invaders that might get into the system. And we'll see in a little while that that's what happens in the case of HIV. That HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, specifically infects those helper T cells and causes their population to plummet. And as that happens, then people with HIV come up with all of these other kinds of novel opportunistic diseases that people with good immune systems never, well, I shouldn't say never, but the very, very low frequency of occurrence in people with good immune systems, but you see them much more commonly in people who are immunocompromised like that. So helper T cells are really important. I've talked to, and note that the helper T cells have those CD4 receptors, and that's an important thing to remember. That's a protein on the outside of the cell that actually is how HIV gets into the cell. It's something that HIV binds to. The killer T cells don't have CD4. They've got CD8, a different related protein on the outside. And they're the ones that go around and do the dirty work, as it were. They're the ones, they will bind, they will find these altered self or non-self cells, and they'll bind to them. And they just kind of like the complement proteins, they will release proteins as a result of that binding that will dissolve into the cell membrane and form holes, perforate the cell membrane so the contents leak out. And so, again, they'll kill cells that way. And that's why they're called killer T cells. That's what they do. That's the primary function, or the primary way that they work. Another way they work in some cases, and I don't think it's clear why, it's just fairly rare, where they'll cause a walling off of whatever that infectious agent is. So if we can't, if we're not going to kill them, let's wall them off. So that kind of puts them in jail, as it were, right, walled off. And tuberculosis is the good example of that. So, you know, if a doctor suspects you may have had tuberculosis at some time in the past, what do? They give you a chest x-ray, right? And they're looking for little dark spots, little walled off areas in the lungs that would indicate that you've had tuberculosis. So that's another way that those guys might work. You saw this overhead that kind of shows that killer T cell, natural killer cell, another name for them. You see them abbreviated as NKCs, natural killer cells, or killer T cells. I kind of like killer T cells. Assassin out there with people. Anyway, bind to the foreign cell, release these proteins down in, and there are those little holes that I was talking about. Proteins literally dissolving into the membrane and forming these large holes that contents leak out, and that kills them. Okay, we're good so far? She covered all this? You don't know? Thank you. So, then the last little bit, talk about types of immunity. You know, is it passive or active immunity? And that's an important distinction to make, too, because, like, if somebody gets bit with a King Cobra, what do? You try to rush them to the hospital, you try to get them an injection of an antitoxin and an antiserum of some sort so that they won't die from that toxin that's gotten into their system. Now, if their humoral system becomes, let me rephrase this. If an individual that has been bitten numerous times by, say, a rattlesnake or a cobra or whatever, they will develop an immunity to the toxin. You can, because antibodies, another thing that antibodies will do is bind to toxins. It doesn't have to be a whole organism. They can bind to unique proteins that are recognized as antigens in the system and deactivate them and get them removed. So like if you are, you have some crazy death wish and you're out there handling rattlesnakes all the time,
and every so often you're getting bit by them, you can develop an immunity to that.
But I guarantee you most people don't have the immunity. So yeah, question. Go out and get bit by a rattlesnake, what do? You try to make cuts, you try to draw out as much of the fluid as you can and so forth. You know you're in trouble, you try to get in to see the doctor and get that injection. And that's what we call a passive immunity, right? Because we can kind of get the benefit of immunity without really being immune by doing that, but that injection, that's going to pass away after a short period of time. And then you're going to be subject to that toxin again. So that's the passive, the idea of a passive immunity versus active. Active immunity means that's what we're talking about. The person actually is immune to the rattlesnake bite. You've been confronted with it enough times that your immune system has mounted a defense. You have a lot of antibodies in your blood. And you're going to take care of that yourself. You're not going to need the injection. So we see those two different kind of categories of immunity that we might have. So once you got the memory cells there, they can respond fairly quickly to taking care of whatever the problem is. Okay, so there was this little summary sort of thing here, kind of summarizing these different things, right? So talking about the B cells, which have these unique antibody, given B cell that we find is only going to have one type of antibody sticking out on it. They don't have a whole smorgasbord of antibodies. One antibody that's sticking out that they even haven't come in contact with. You know, it may just be an experimental antibody that's out there. It doesn't come in contact, and there can be other ones that show up also. But again, if you actually confronted that antigen, then you're going to have those memory cells also. So you get an antigen that binds tightly to the antibody, T cells are helping in this response, then you get that differentiation. T cells start to divide, right, and they'll form these plasma cells, which are really antibody factories. And I think you probably saw this diagram. This is an active, that's a plasma cell. And you look, huge nucleus in there. That doesn't mean a whole lot, but everything else that's out here, all this stuff you see, is a rough endoplasmic reticulum. Remember from last term, rough endoplasmic reticulum is where protein for transport out of the cell is made. And so these plasma cells are filled with that rough endoplasmic reticulum because they're making all this antibody that's going to get kicked out of the cell and transported somewhere else.
All right, so make the antibodies. Also have that memory cell line that's going to persist for a long period of time, which will allow you to have a much more rapid response. So that was the humoral. This was the cell mediated down here, killer T cells. They have their own assortment of proteins on the outside. When they come across the non-cell or the altered self cell, sometimes it's the self cell, which is bad. They will bind to that cell. Right, and either kill them directly or cause their walling off. And again, we get a memory, we get memory cells formed from the killer T cells so that
the next time we come across those sorts of things, we'll have a faster response to them also. So that's kind of the quick and dirty summary of the immune system. This is diagram that you find in your text, right, that kind of does the same thing. There's the helper T cell. Notice it's just centered to everything and helping to bring about the response, helping the humoral response over on this side, helping the cell-mediated response over on this side, and responding to macrophages have been chewing things up and presenting proteins on the outside and letting the immune system know that there's a problem out there. Okay, so you got through all of that last time, right? So this has just been the longest review in the world that you've ever seen. It's like, what's new to talk about? So the exam is going to go through that, right? So the stuff I'm going to talk with you about now is not going to be on this exam. It will be probably rearing its ugly head on the final exam when we come around to that. Any questions before I dive in here? Yeah. Okay, let me reorganize myself here really quickly because I got this stacks of stuff here. And see.
This review, by the way, has been posted now to the website, so you can download it. I posted that this morning, so
it's there. Unfortunately, Erica confessed that she did not turn on the recorder, and so there's no audio file for her lecture. I'm kind of disappointed. I wanted to listen in on her, but that's life. So let's talk a little bit about allergies now. What in the world are allergies? Why do we have allergies? It's still a good question. Like, why do we have to suffer with allergies? What is their function? People are kind of coming up with some ideas now as to why we might have to deal with allergies. But, you know, allergies can be life-threatening. Allergies are a response of the immune system that can kill you. And so what's going on there? So whereas we've been talking about substances that will elicit immune responses on the humoral side and the cell-mediated side, now we're going to talk about substances that will elicit responses to allergies. And we call those things allergens. Allergens are any substance that will stimulate an allergic response. Allergens. Yeah, allergens. Okay, so you know, maybe it's just the runny nose. Maybe it's the scratchy eyes. Maybe it's the sneezing. Maybe it's the constricted air passageways. Maybe it's lack of intestinal absorption. There are lots of different kinds of responses to allergies. You know, the interesting thing about the allergic response is that it's basically a response to histamine release. Now, you may remember histamines back when you looked at the inflammatory response. Okay, histamines have particular things that they do in the inflammatory response. One of the things they do is make capillaries leakier, right? And so if you have a major histamine release in your nose because an allergen got in there, all of a sudden you got this runny nose. Well, there are the leaky capillaries doing their thing, and so forth. So it's generally a histamine or a leukotriene. I'll talk about those in a minute. They may be involved too. It may not just be histamines, but primarily that. So what's going on? On first exposure, it's pretty much like the humoral immune response that you've dealt with earlier. You're not going to get an allergic response on first exposure. What happens is the allergen is going to bind with a specialized type of B cell. Now remember, it's the B cells that are going to bind upon exposure to a foreign antigen and bind and begin to create the antibodies. Well, there are certain kinds of B cells called plasmacytes. So the allergen binds to a plasmacyte. So that's just a special kind of B cell, or a certain kind of B cell. I shouldn't call it special. We don't like them. Okay, so it's going to bind to the plasmacyte, which is going to produce immunoglobulin proteins. But rather than producing IgG, which is the one that you find out in the blood or in the body fluids and so forth, rather than producing IgG, they produce IgE. So it causes the plasmacyte to produce IgE. Now, IgE is interesting because,
go back to my,
so remember, the immunoglobulin protein has this kind of Y structure to it, like that. These were the binding sites, so again, two allergen binding sites up here, and then there was the stem down here. In the case of IgE, the stem has a different structure, and that causes it to be inserted into the cell membrane of cells called mast cells. Okay, inserted into the cell membranes of mast cells. Now, it's where that allergen has come into contact. So is it in the nose, is it the eyes, is it in the intestinal tract, is it a food allergy? Where has that come into contact? Most of them are called mast cells in the blood. So this has been an allergen that's gotten into the blood. There's a type of blood cell called a basophil. That those IgE will get inserted into. So mast cells, or in the blood, it's a basophil. Now, the way they insert, so let's just draw a little mast cell here, a little cell like that. So they're going to insert with the stem down there, and then again, the binding, the allergen binding arms, the sites, are sticking out. So you produce a lot of the allergen, get a lot of the allergen, you get a lot of this IgE in there. So now our mast cells have this kind of a coating. If there's cells lining the intestinal tract, that coating is only going to be on the outside, you know, the side facing the lumen of the intestinal tract and so forth. If it's in the basophils, it's going to be surrounding them and whatnot. So we've got this. Now, that's first exposure. Okay, we haven't had any kind of allergic response to that or anything, no sort of allergic reaction. Along comes the second exposure. Okay, what happens? If the allergen binds to two adjacent IgE molecules, okay, so I don't know what our allergen is. Let's say it's a pollen grain or something, a big pollen grain. If you get that in, say in your nose, and it binds to two adjacent IgE molecules like that, that triggers the release of histamine. Okay, triggers release of histamine, and also leukotrienes. I have to include those, because the leukotrienes have kind of been in and out of this picture. For a while, it was looking like the allergic response might be more caused by leukotrienes than histamines, but that kind of goes back and forth. We'll just put them both there. So it doesn't matter whether we're talking about really a mast cell in the nose or the skin or something, or we're talking about a basophil that's in the blood, is going to trigger the release of these. Now, the severity of the symptoms are going to depend upon how much of this stuff is being released. Okay, the more of it that gets released, the more severe the symptoms are going to be. So, and also it depends on the location. So, for example, a massive allergic response through your sinus tissues might give you a really bad runny nose and scratchy eyes and so forth, but that's probably not going to be life-threatening. A massive histamine released by the basophils into the blood could be very life-threatening, because that histamine will then go and cause the closing down of the air passageways and can kill you. Yeah. So we get these histamine and leukotrienes circulating. They cause increased leakiness of the blood capillaries. They can cause contraction of the smooth muscle around the bronchioles going into the lungs. They can do all sorts of bad things to you. And as they clear out of the system, then once the allergen is gone, as they clear out of the system, of course, you're going to start to come back to normal. So how do we treat that? What do you use if you're having an allergy attack? What's the chemical of choice? Antihistamine, right? Antihistamine, because that's going to bind the histamine. And if you look on some of the allergy medications, you see that also the anti-leukotrienes. Now I've got to tell you, antihistamines got kind of a bad name a while ago because of some of their side effects and stuff. And so you may not find that term antihistamine on a package. What you may find is histamine blocker. Okay, when you see the term histamine blocker, that's just a repackaged antihistamine. Or a leukotriene blocker. So you may see that kind of terminology on the medication also. But what's its function is to remove the histamine, remove the leukotriene from circulating, and then kind of calm down that whole reaction. So why do we have, yeah?
Why do specific people have reactions to it? That's a really good question. it's true. I mean, if we were to sample everybody in this room, we'd find that people are allergic to different things. Right? And I can't give you a good explanation for that.
So, why do we have allergies? You know, what is going on with that? And it seems like people are getting more and more allergic as time goes on. You know, is it because we're better at identifying them? You always worry about that. If you see something that's increasing over time, you say, well, maybe we're just reporting it better and we're knowing about it better. Or is it that there's truly something going on? And you worry a little bit about the immune system. The immune system, in my mind, has to be kept occupied. If you don't keep the immune system occupied, then it seems to have a propensity to get into mischief on its own. It'll find mischief. So it's like autoimmune diseases. Why do we see so many autoimmune diseases now than we used to see, and so forth? And I suspect that part of this, anyway, has to do with our societal desire to be bacteria-free and absolutely spotless and clean. It worries me the amount of antibacterials that are being put into everything anymore, it seems. Not just soaps, but you know, build them into your cutting board for your kitchen, put them in children's toys, put them here and there. You know, it's probably good to let your kids eat a little dirt, because they're going to be confronted with various kinds of bacteria and so forth, and that's going to stimulate their immune response. And they're going to, that's what our immune system is designed to do. But I suspect that some of the problems we're having have to do with this sterile environment that we're trying to create for ourselves, which isn't necessarily the best environment to have. Now, I'm not saying let's all go out and take a swim at the wastewater treatment plant and see who can get across the pond first. But I think people ought to think a little bit about what they're doing in terms of trying to be absolutely sterile. Because I think that allows the immune system to get into a little bit of mischief that it wouldn't ordinarily do. Now, that's not the solution, obviously, to allergies. Allergies have been with us for a long, long time. But that may account for some of the increasing number of allergies that we're seeing in recent times. So treatments would be the antihistamines, the antileukotrienes. That's kind of a topical, quick, we've got to treat this sort of thing. Desensitization, you hear about that, where people will go in for allergy tests and the doctor will take and make a whole series of little scratches on their skin and then apply different kinds of potential allergens and look to see whether there's any kind of a reaction to those or not. And by seeing what that individual is reacting to, they can put together a concoction of those allergens, which then that individual will start getting as a regular series of injections to try to bring up an IgG response to capture those allergens before they can do the IgE, get the IgE response and so forth. Sometimes it works for people, sometimes it doesn't work. Desensitization doesn't always work. And it could be a really, really long process and take several years as you gradually, ever so slowly, increase the amount of allergen that you're getting in your regular injections. But it is one way of trying to deal with this. Is there any purpose to allergies? You know, it's like, why do our bodies do this? And there have been a variety of things that have proposed, you know, like, for example, does the extra leakiness in the capillaries, does that perhaps help white blood cells to get into different areas of the body? Does it perhaps protect from parasites? And that's one of the areas that people are looking at more and more. Is it possible that an allergic response would, at least if it's in the sinuses and places, that would help to kind of maybe wash out some parasites? I'm not quite sure how food allergies would relate to that, but
people are trying to figure out why does the immune system behave that way? I'm sure that in the next little while some better answers will come up, but I'm not sure, other than the parasite idea, I'm not sure that there are any great answers. And of course, we don't worry about parasites too much, do we? Because we live squeaky clean lives. So again, we're cheating our immune systems from being able to help us by leading those clean lives. But allergies are a kind of an immune response that we wish we didn't have, but we do have. And it may actually be deeply rooted in something that's very useful. We just don't know that yet. Let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk with you a little bit about HIV and see what's going on with that. Okay, let's get started again. It was called to my attention that I made a critical mistake very, very early on when I was announcing the exam. And on the sheet that I had written up, I said, study questions, page 56, all, and it should be 1 to 12, because that, I told you, we're not going to have anything about allergies and HIV, and 13 on is allergies and HIV. So please, don't let that fool you, and if people ask you, you can tell them. It's only questions 1 through 12 on page 56. Okay, so silly me, I just don't know how that happened. Okay, HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, causes AIDS, right? Now, the AIDS virus is a really interesting virus, believe it or not. Something I talked with you a little bit about last term, for those of you that were here. But HIV belongs to a group of viruses that we call retroviruses. And they're called retroviruses because they don't play by the rules that most things play by. Okay, if you look in a retrovirus and you look at their genetic material, and that's what we find here in these little the yellow strands there are meant to reflect the genetic material. The genetic material is not DNA, it's RNA. And for everything else, the genetic material, the information is carried, is held in DNA. But retroviruses, it's RNA. And until HIV was identified as the cause of evasion of AIDS, retroviruses were known. They were looked upon as just kind of these oddities of nature. Aren't they kind of interesting? Look, they've got RNA instead of DNA. Of course, once HIV was pinned down as the cause of AIDS, then people got a whole lot more interested in knowing a whole lot more about retroviruses. What we know about them, at least what we know about HIV, is that it's got RNA at its heart. It's typical for a virus. It's got a protein capsule that sits around it. And then typical for animal viruses, it has a membrane that surrounds that. And that membrane has come from the animal host cell. The host cells. Now what will happen is this membrane gives HIV entry into a cell, but specific entry. HIV enters cells with that CD4 protein on the outside. So we think of those as docking proteins. It's going to bind to that. If you've got the CD4 on the outside, or whatever cells of yours have CD4 on the outside, those are cells that could be infected by HIV. There's a second protein on the outside that's required also. And it turns out that a very small percent of the population doesn't have that second protein. And those people are actually immune to HIV infection because they don't have that second protein. But something like 95-96% of the population has that, and then therefore are potentials for getting HIV infection. Once that virus binds to the outside, it opens up to the inside. That allows the inner viral particle to get in. The RNA is released from the protein coating that it's in. And then the interesting thing about that is, because most things work from DNA, and this actually has to work from DNA also, with retroviruses, they all carry some copies of this protein, this little red
cherries here, called reverse transcriptase.
Reverse transcriptase is a protein that will take RNA and will make double-stranded DNA copies of that RNA. So reverse transcriptase, you may remember transcription was the process of making an RNA copy of a DNA molecule. Reverse transcriptase, going the opposite direction, we're going to take a single-stranded RNA molecule, we're then going to form double-stranded DNA molecules from that. And that DNA then is going to insert itself into the host genome, into the host DNA, and it's going to work its mischief from that location, just like we understand DNA to work. And it will direct the cells then to slowly make more viral protein. It will direct the cells to make more viral RNA. These pieces, the blue proteins encasing the RNA and the reverse transcriptase all self-assemble, so that we don't have to have something out there putting them together. They just kind of self will come together and make more viral particles. And then as this viral particle leaves the cell, it's going to go to the edge of the membrane and it'll just leb off another little piece of membrane. So as that's leaving, it picks up this membrane coat that was from the host cell. So now it can go out if you want to infect another cell. In order to be able to do some of this, the viral DNA directs the formation of specific viral proteins that embed themselves into the outer membrane of the cell that they're in. And as those proteins increase in number, and this is real typical for animal viruses, as those proteins increase in number, then your immune system is going to start to recognize that as an altered self-cell. Because all of a sudden we've got these strange proteins showing up in this membrane that shouldn't be there.
Okay, and those proteins are absolutely necessary for the virus to get in the cells. So that's what HIV is doing.
HIV is a very slow-growing virus. Many animal viruses are that way. They don't just quickly make a whole bunch of copies and burst the cell open and here we are out in the town finding more animal cells. They tend to be slow over a period of time, just blubbing off more and more viral particles, which then go out and infect other cells. Did you have a question? Okay, so we got this. Now, what cells have CD4 proteins on the outside? Well, we talked about the helper T cells, right? So that's one class of cells that HIV will affect. Second class of cells are cells lining the rectum. Okay, so those are cells that can be infected. And the third class of cells that have CD4 proteins, receptors on the outside, are certain nerve cells. So there are certain nerve cells in the central nervous system that can be infected by HIV also. And sometimes you hear about people dying from nerve diseases that are related to HIV infection, but usually that's not what kills people. There are other things that get them before that a big nervous infection can get them. Okay, so it's got to have the CD4 on the outside. Now here's a
time course of HIV infection. Okay, now, notice that we're looking at years down here. One of the problems with HIV has been that it takes so long from the time of the initial infection for the time when you may begin to see the results, especially if it goes into full-blown AIDS, probably 7, 8, 9 years. And there's cause and effect. The cause is so far removed from the effect that people don't make a connection. And so many people who are at risk for HIV infection, not making the connection, figure out, that's not going to happen in the air, it's way down the road, so I'm going to worry about it. Okay, so what do we got here? Relative HIV concentration. Okay, so when you are first infected with HIV, the viral load goes up dramatically. Your body responds by making antibody. Okay, so we're going to respond to that just like we do anything else. And you see, as the antibody concentration goes up, the viral load goes down. It's the viral load in the blood. Okay, but it gets to a point where it kind of bottoms out. Okay, there's still a significant viral load in the blood. Now, HIV is kind of, what's the right word? It's deceptive in that it hides out in the cells that it's infected in. Okay, being a slow reproducing virus, it'll just sit there, and very slowly these cells are unwittingly producing more and more viral particles that are going to contribute to the viral load wherever it is. They'll just keep going. Eventually, HIV will mess the cell's internal workings up so much that it will kill the cell itself. But that takes a long time to do, because again, it's a slow virus. So that happens. Now, the other thing to look at on this graph is the T cell. This is helper T cell concentration. Okay, so initially, responding to HIV infection, as you would expect, the helper T cell concentration goes up. So we're seeing that immune response that's starting, and we're seeing the antibodies go up and so forth. But as time goes on, helper T cell concentration goes down. And it's not just because the helper T cells then go, we'll take care of that problem, let's move on to the next, right? That there may be a little bit of that there as when that drops precipitously. But it's more because those helper T cells themselves are being affected by HIV. And the HIV ultimately is killing the helper T cells. And so we see it, HIV infected person, the T cell concentration goes down, and as it goes, gets lower and lower, you see what happens to the relative HIV concentration is going to start to go up, because the helper T cells are no longer helping to stimulate responses.
So that's what happens in the progression of HIV infection. The individual, when they're first infected, maybe several weeks after the initial infection, may feel like they just kind of the flu or something. It may take a week or two to get over it and so forth, and then things are fine, right? Until way out here, if untreated, and if it's allowed to go to full-blown AIDS, then they start to feel hung again and start to get to where they really aren't responding well to infections. And that's because the helper T cell concentration is so, so low. Now, do people die directly from AIDS infection? Not really. Some of them that where it infects the brain, you may say, okay, well, they maybe died directly from HIV infection. But most people don't die directly from HIV infection. They die from other things. So there were two diseases in particular that that doctors were seeing when HIV was first hit the scene back in the early 80s. And of course, I didn't write them down, and now I can't remember them. One is a parasite infection, and one is a cancer, a very rare cancer, yeah.
Actually, around 80% or something, but but you're right. By the time they were seeing that, they had to have been infected, count back a few years, 7-8 years earlier, and now we were seeing kind of the end stages of that happening. But we know that HIV infection goes back a lot farther than that. So people thought, oh, it's something new that just popped onto the scene. No, it had been around. It was just not very prevalent at the time, and the epidemiologists hadn't seen it, hadn't made the connection yet that there was something going on.
It's been done, and there are different various scenarios. You know, did it come in through Haiti? Did it come in from here or there or whatever? What we know is we have it. Here it is, and here's the problem. So what do you do to treat it? You know, there are lots of different things that have been tried. We know that HIV, if left untreated, is going to basically destroy the immune response. So it's these diseases that you ordinarily wouldn't get, or if you were confronted with them, you wouldn't. They wouldn't be able to take hold. Well, once you're immunocompromised, then it's a whole different story. And so, actually, you know, think about it. Transplant people have kind of similar problems because we immunosuppress them to keep the body from trying to reject the transplant. There are people occasionally that are born that have no immune response. You've probably all heard about the bubble boy. No immune response at all. And so he was literally kept in a bubble for his entire life, which ended, how old was he? Did he finally crawl out of the bubble? I can't remember, but there are some like that. Anyway, so what do we do? How do we do this? So there have been various strategies that have been tried. One strategy that people thought was a great idea, which probably wasn't too bad of an idea, was to attack it at its basic level. We know that once that virus gets into the cell, the reverse transcriptase has to be able to make the DNA, the double strand of DNA. So how about if we poison the reverse transcriptase? Because we don't use reverse transcriptase in our own bodies. If you could find something that would specifically target and poison the reverse transcriptase, then you might be able to prevent HIV. It might get into the cell, but it's not going to be able to truly infect the cell. It's not going to be able to go there. And so the drug AZT is a reverse transcriptase inhibitor. And you know, AZT has been used for a long time as one of a cocktail of drugs to treat HIV. It hasn't been the magic bullet. It's helped. But it hasn't been the magic bullet. What about vaccinations to stimulate long-term immunity? We talked about how the body does respond initially, and in fact, antibody concentration in people infected with HIV tends to remain fairly high as the HIV load drops, but it just keeps pumping it out long-term and kind of overwhelms the antibody. What about vaccination? And that's been a really, really tricky one because HIV tends to be quite variable. And once it gets in, it will mutate. It'll change also. So 9 months after infection, if you were to compare the HIV at the initial infection with 9 months later,
you may find that there's a different variant of HIV that is mutated along the way. And if you're going to use immunity, if you're going to try to inoculate and stimulate immunity, you need something that's not going to keep changing. Right? You need a protein. Just find me a protein on the outer surface of that virus that isn't going to change with time so that we can know that we've got something. And in fact, in the last month and a half or so, there was a news report that came out that looked really promising, that some research scientists think they may have found that protein now, that they're going to be able to use and develop an immunization, and we'll wait and see what happens with that. But that would be one thing that would be nice to do. What about blocking the CD4 receptor? Okay, we talked about how the CD4 receptor is a necessary entry pathway for the virus. So people have tried that. The problem is that CD4 receptor isn't there just in case HIV comes along, right? It's like, what else is it doing? And nobody understood the natural function of the CD4 receptor protein. So you go in there and start blocking it, and you don't know what the cascade of events is going to be as other things start to go awry and so forth. Turns out that CD4 is important for various cell-cell bonding activities. It's important for the cytotoxic T-cell reaction, the killer T-cell reaction, and so forth. So it probably isn't the best idea in the world to block the CD4 receptor. It's there for a reason, and we need that. One of the more clever ideas, I think, was to use what are called protease inhibitors. Let me write that down. Protease inhibitors. A protease is an enzyme, there's the ASE ending, it's an enzyme that breaks apart proteins. Okay? So a protease inhibitor is going to limit that, it's going to prevent that activity. Well, why would that be useful? It turns out that HIV is kind of unique in that when it's making its unique proteins that are needed, it makes a stretch of 3 proteins all at once. Does it make them individually like normally you think that it'll do? It makes the 3, and then it depends upon proteases to cleave those into their individual proteins so that they can be inserted in the membrane or wherever. So that was why people thought, well, if we could prevent that from happening, then maybe we could prevent HIV infection from happening because the protein would just be one long one rather than the 3 shorter ones. And that's not going to work the proper way. Maybe we could prevent that virus from replicating itself and making more copies. And the protease inhibitors have had a certain degree of success also. So people with HIV infection generally get a cocktail of things that have different functions and so forth. And hopefully that will knock it down. Now, a cautionary word here, and it's the same cautionary word that I would apply to if you're like taking an antibiotic or something. You have to be very careful. You have to, if you're going to try to knock something like HIV down with a cocktail of drugs, you need to hit that hard and fast, and you need to get rid of all the cells if you can. Because if you don't, the ones that survive are going to be much harder to deal with the next round. And so it's always a concern with a lot of people that are being treated for HIV. Are they going to continue taking the drugs? Are they going to get to where they think, oh, I'm feeling pretty good, I don't need to take them anymore, and people tend to do things like that, or what? And it's just like if you're given a 10-day supply of antibiotics, your doctor says, take them all, right? Don't stop halfway through. It's the same idea. You've got bacteria that have varying degrees of sensitivity to the drugs, and if you go the full course, you likely have a good chance of knocking them all out. But if you don't go the full course, the stronger ones, the ones that are less sensitive, are going to be the ones that are going to reproduce at that point. And when you hit them the next time, it's going to be that much harder to get rid of them. So you always want to go with the full course. I've got a couple of videos I want to show you. Let me finish with that. I think you'll get a kick out of these.